What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's Resistance in Residence artists are the dynamic duo that make up Oyster Knife, a post-disciplinary performance company. We're joined by Gabriel Christian. Good morning, Gabriel.
Good morning.
As well as Chibuizwe Crouch. Good morning.
Chibuizwe, yep.
Chibuizwe.
And Gabrielle. Yeah.
And Gabrielle.
And Gabrielle. Mm-hmm. I'll get it in a couple more years. Promise. I want to start. So I also have to say, like, I've had the opportunity to work with Oyster Knife, and the FCC now says that I have to tell them that I was paid for that work, even though that work is over, which makes absolutely no sense to me. But there you go, FCC. Hope you're happy. I want to start with you all as individuals. And Gabrielle, I'll start with you. Talk about a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, what your family was like.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Hi, Gabriel Christian here. I moved to the Bay 10 years ago. I'm from Harlem, New York, and I went to school out in New Haven, at Yale for 4 years until 2013. And then I moved here in 2014 to SF and then Oakland, and now I'm back in SF. It's been a really kind of wild trajectory. I started off as an actor, a physical actor, I would say, and then moved more into like dramaturgy, and then I got cast as a dancer and an excess production, and now I'm kind of working consistently as a dancer choreographer and also leading a company now. I'm called Jess Curtis Gravity. Jess Curtis is someone who passed away in March, really landmark choreographer in the Bay who kind of helped make a lot of the experimental scene the way it is today, very contact improvisation centered. So I'm stepping in to keep this company alive, and a lot of the work we do is about accessibility. So I'm in this place now where as an artist I'm moving from just like making my own work to also thinking about how to make work across the Bay Area more accessible by offering people description, primarily blind and visually impaired folks, description that helps them be able to access the productions that they're seeing. But back to, you know, my own practice is really rooted in like excavating the archive, in like experimental installations in text and poetry, which is really where I would say I started years and years ago in New York when I was a little fledgling in an all-boys school, chasing after some sense of self and feeling really queer and didn't know how to talk about it until I got words on a page. And I met Chibuizwe, which changed my life, and she'll talk about herself shortly, but that's the beginning.
Chi?
Oh, I love that. We did change each other's lives.
And you're going to tell that story. That's going to be the question after you tell us about a little bit about you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm Chibuizwe Crouch. Recently, I added my mom's last name. So actually, I now go by Chibuizwe Crouch in Yoruba. I was raised in Connecticut. My mother is an Igbo Nigerian woman. My dad is a white dude from Newtown. And what to say? Yeah, I also went to university at Yale with Gabrielle. That's where I met them. And while I was there, I started out in a lot of a cappella. I also did a lot of theater, but I studied gender studies, which really, I think, kind of transformed how I see the world and kind of added a more political framing to a lot of the work I ended up eventually making. After university, I lived in Trinidad and Tobago, actually, for a year, working at Trinidad Theater Workshop, which is the oldest theater company in the Caribbean. And that was the first place that I encountered masquerade outside of my own cultural context in Nigeria, in this like Caribbean mixed context where, you know, I saw things happening that I'd never seen before in masquerade, especially the role of like women and queer folks in masquerade tradition. And that kind of set a trajectory for me, even though at the time I was doing theater, I also started out mostly doing acting in my professional career. After Trinidad, I moved back to Connecticut, and then I eventually moved to the Bay in 2016, joining Gabe and also a bunch of other friends who had just moved there. And I started out, in the theater, but I think over time, I slowly kind of grew dissatisfied with some of the limitations I felt as an actor of color, as an actor who was queer, and kind of realized that I wanted more creative control and more multidisciplinarity in my work to honor like my singing, to honor my poetry background, to honor my growing interest in masquerade. And then Gabrielle and I kind of decided to just make our own company. We decided to do Oyster Knife, and that's where I kind of that became the vehicle for me to start doing a lot of more ritual theater and doing a lot more multidisciplinary work that kind of honored the different gifts that I have, like I said, in singing and writing and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, my own practice, I would say it's very ritual theater based. I would say it's very spirit centered. A lot of it is inspired by Igbo cosmology, Afro-diasporic cultures and traditions through a queer lens. And a lot of it's about community involvement, community making through theater and through participatory work. I also make video work. I started making video work in 2020. And so that has also kind of explored similar themes of like Igbo cosmology and Afro-queer realities, embodiments, lives. So yeah, that's me.
You just used a bunch of big words real fast.
No,
it's good. It's good. For my listeners, Igbo cosmology. Is that what you said?
Igbo cosmology. Yeah, basically just Igbo ways of being, Igbo ways of life.
All right. Which one of you wants to tell the story about how you met?
I can start.
Yes, please. You start.
All right, Gabe, you go.
So I think it was 2010. I'm a year above Chibweze in college, and there was a show. Was it called?
Kaleidoscope?
Kaleidoscope, thank you. Called Kaleidoscope, where actually it was a show that I was acting in. It was like a freshman orientation show. As part of that show, we all wrote our own sort of monologues about our experience being students across demographics at school. And I was talking about being a Black queer student, being a student who came from, you know, Harlem and was kind of shocked by the sociopolitical like strife or like the differences I was noticing in the town between like university and the folks who worked for the university, folks who lived in New Haven. And so I wrote a little thing about that. And I think I ended the entry or the monologue saying, I'm proud of my Vespertine crown. I'm proud of my hair, basically. And so Chibweze emails me after the show, which I didn't really realize. She was a freshman at the time, and she saw the work, and she, I guess, was really moved by the monologue. But she emailed me, and I don't think I responded, but maybe Chibweze can talk
about
that.
You did not respond, Boo. You did not.
But I think ultimately it was great because, you know, fate put us into the same dormitory, and Chibweze is coming to school with many of her siblings. I won't talk all about that. That's for you to talk about. But she came with a lot of siblings of hers. So there already was like a bit of a wrestling on campus about, oh my God, these four folks are coming to campus, first time in history. So Chibweze, I knew about them, and we were both miraculously theater majors. In the same dormitory. So we were running into each other all the time in the cafeteria. And I think, you know, I think just being both like kind of, you know, weird, really multi-talented Black queer kids in a school that's really, doesn't really always know how to produce or hold our complexities or the sort of the, our vicissitudes or the way that we want to move through different types of expression very quickly. It was clear that we were kin. So we, you know, started performing in the same shows, often cast like next to each other. Chibweze was in my senior thesis, which is a show I didn't even choose, which is The Misanthrope by Molière, which is, you know, like such a, can be a really like, you know, cardboard kind of production if you're not careful. But I think doing it with Chibweze was fab, and the language ended up being really fun, I think, in our mouths. And then getting out of school, yeah, coming out of school, seeing how Chibweze went off into the Caribbean and came back to the Bay when I was here. It was clear that our stuff in college was still kind of in our gums. So we decided to keep on pursuing that route. But I think it's clear that that first monologue, that first moment at the freshman orientation was sort of the seed for how we both think about what you can and cannot say, what you have permission to say in institutional spaces especially. Like, definitely feels like we're rebellious at the core. So I think it made sense that that's where we started.
Yeah, that's the story. I was just gonna add that I saw Gabe after that monologue with Shay and seeing it and being inspired by it and emailing them about it. I actually saw them on my first day on campus with my sister, and that was where it kind of kicked off from there. And I think you eventually did respond to the email, but it was like well after we met. It definitely was not, you know, right when I emailed you. Which, you know, is fine. I still have it.
Still the case today. I still email people weeks later.
It's true. Gabe is definitely the 3 to 4, 3 to 5 business days kind of
exactly. Not ministry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so what Gabe was also kind of alluding to is that I went to Yale with my three other siblings. I'm one of quadruplets. I'm the oldest of quadruplets, and we were the first set of quadruplets to go to Yale together. So there's now another set. So it's old news. It's not interesting anymore. But at the time, it was a big deal. And so that's why Gabe knew who I was before I got there. But and now Gabe is friends with my entire family. He's one of the proud and the few. So
but I still haven't been to the house, which is miraculous.
Which is crazy. That we have to change that. That's going to change.
For the record, I would love to hear Moliere in your mouths. I imagine that was spicy. I actually want to go back to you. So I was married to a trini for a really long time, and I spent my fair share of time in that country. And one of the things that, but you know, I understand about it, and for my friends that are queer and trini, it's just not the safest of places for queer folks. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering about your experience there. And mm-hmm. I actually have never engaged in the arts there. So, I mean, outside of carnival, right? Like I've done carnival, of course, but, you know, in theater or dance companies. And so I'm wondering, is it sort of like here as much as here is, you know, where the theater is a safer place? Was that refuge? Let me stop talking because now I'm putting words in your mouth.
No, I appreciate that question. I'll just preface this to say that, you know, I'm obviously not Trinidadian. I'm not Caribbean. I am just somebody who has a lot of friends there. It was a very formative, creative and personal time for me to live there after college. And I would say, it's ironic, like my entire community of friends in Trinidad are all queer people. And I actually ended up doing a lot of queer activism and organizing in Trinidad, like with other queer artists, using the arts as kind of like a vehicle of creating more acceptance and tolerance and understanding of queer folks in Trinidad. It was through this group called I Am One, which is actually still in existence, run by a person named Zelika Julian, who's a really great artist, writer, and like activist in Trinidad. And so, yeah, to answer your question, I would say Trinidad is like nothing like America in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a very uniquely Caribbean place. And it's a very mixed space. It's a very, I would call it like a third space. I think that's a term I've learned recently about like spaces where these hybrid cultures kind of come together and create a completely different new world and new culture out of the mixing of Black and Indian and Asian and Indigenous and European backgrounds and cultures that have coalesced in that space. And so, yeah, I mean, Trinidad, you know, in a lot of ways, it is an unsafe space for queer people. But I would also say that compared to some other countries, it's not necessarily as severe. That being said, I think it completely depends on your positionality as a queer person. If you're trans, it's probably a lot more unsafe for you than, say, if you're a cis gay man or something like that. And I can't say I can speak for all queer people in Trinidad, but it really depends on your privilege, your gender presentation, how visibly queer you are, and how much you choose to share that. And also, so much has changed from 2016 to now. When I first got there, we did the very first Pride Arts Festival, is what we called it, where we did a queer musical using like soca and traditional Caribbean and Trinidad music and characters that we wrote ourselves, and did a performance at this Black Box Theater that's run by a Rapso group whose members are actually, two of their members are queer, and everybody knows that, but nobody really cares because they're famous Rapso members. So it's like that kind of thing. And then since then, now they have had at least 1 or 2 years of like full pride parades. So, and they also struck down the anti-buggery law that would, you know, institute a lot of homophobic legal policies in the first place. So a lot of things have changed from when I was first there. Does it mean it's a completely safe space? No. But does it also mean, you know, I don't want to, you know, reinforce any kind of stereotypes either about it, because I would also say America in a lot of ways is not a safe place to be trans or queer in different ways, depending on your positionality. So was the arts a safe space and a refuge for queer people? 100%. Yes. I would say that was my experience and the experience of some of my friends. Is that true for everybody? Not necessarily. But yeah, the theater and like making music and making musical theater is what I specifically did with this group. That became a space where we could talk about our experiences very openly and like use local musical styles and theatrical styles to talk about queerness in a way that maybe wasn't happening as much at the time. But I would also say a lot has changed since then, hopefully for the better. But yeah, I would say, yeah, Trini folks who are there, Trini queer folks can say a lot more than I can. But it's a very special place. And yeah, I really miss it a lot. I miss living there.
Yeah, I refuse to give it up in the divorce. I still go every
year. I don't blame you. It's
like, yeah. No, you don't get this. Sorry.
And the art scene there is so rich, Kat. I hope you can go back and like maybe do theater there yourself, because it's incredible the things that are happening and the artists who are there making really great theater, visual art, film. They have a huge literary festival there every year. It's a really, really beautiful art scene. Yeah.
Huh. tucking that nugget away for further exploration. Gabe, I'm going to bring you back in the conversation, and then Chi, you can add on to it. I want to hear you talk to the listeners about y'all's process.
Yeah, it started in 2017 when we decided to apply for the Queer Communities Cohort, QCC, National Queer Arts Festival, really commissioned us to make a work. And the first thing that we came up with was sort of, we named ourselves Oyster Knife after Zerona Hurston, just to say that. There's a quote that she has that goes, "No, I do not weep at the worries of the world. I'm too busy sharpening my oyster knife. I'm too busy, you know, dealing with my own and handling myself." And I think in some ways that way of being in rebellion, being in a prideful, almost like a guaranteeing that we can still survive even if we're facing some of the most catastrophic times. I think that's kind of relevant to this moment now. But of course, even back then in 2017, it felt like we were holding that as our ethos. So making a show called Mouthful of Sea that was addressing sort of the complicity, we're thinking about this really poetically, but the complicity of the ocean and carrying the boat over that brought my ancestors over to this coast. And Chibwezi's ancestors aren't from the same lineage. They're from, of course, an Igbo Nigerian context. So thinking about the shore to shore connection, that was our first piece we ever did. It was very intense. We had a maybe 20-minute section in the middle that was trying to reflect what the hold might have been like. And so that was our first work. It got us really kind of into the nitty gritty of the sort of trans diasporic question that the two of our bodies are asking when we're in space together. And I think from there, you know, we started to be like, what else, what other institutions exist that maybe contain this question? And one of them that was clear was the church, the Black faith structures that we've both grown up in, one of them being Igbo Catholic, and mine being, one of them being for Chibwezi, Igbo Catholic, for me being Black Baptist. And of course, also even like would say like things like yoga have come in through my other black folks, but really Black Baptist Church. So finding like the connections between those two different ways of growing up and what things didn't feel comfortable and safe for us. We made a piece in 2019 called Mouthful that was at Counterpulse. And that brought us to 5 years later doing it again, mounting it again at Grace Cathedral, which is our most recent, kind of our biggest show to date, which was a work that was about, as always, our work is about pulling in the archives of the community, like the live living archives, as well as immersing the audience into the work. So we're not sort of separating audience and performer. So in this work, we gave Black folks a chance to enter the church first. We had white folks wait downstairs and watch a film that was about sort of excoriating any of the guilt they might be walking into the church with, so we could have a space that felt more safe for us as Black performers and Black audience to be in with them. We kind of do that a lot, where we want to make sure every audience knows they're complicit and also available to the themes of the work. They're always going to be asked to be aware of themselves and who they're around when they're watching our stuff. I'll say one more piece we did, you know, after Mouthful was Mouth, because we have a trilogy technically, and Mouth was about celebrity. And how celebrity influenced both me and Chibwezi as young queer artists, thinking through Prince and Whitney Houston, a very different kind of direction than before. But I feel like it was like definitely a good way to conclude, bring the era of church and transatlantic slave trade questions into the modern era with celebrity, thinking about what is affecting us now, what are our institutions now, how is fame its own institution. But I'll let Chibwezi say more. I've said quite a bit there.
Yeah, I mean, I think you covered all of it really well. Those have been our like big bodies of work. I think to touch on a little or flesh out a little more of what you said, I think research is a really huge part of our process. Dramaturgy, really. Both of us are very nerdy people, constantly like looking up different things, different themes that interest us, playing a lot, exploring a lot in rehearsal. I feel like the rehearsal process and the research process is personally my favorite part and probably the most generative part for both of us and for our different casts and people that we work with, where we just try a lot of things and do a lot of poetic prompts that lead to improvisation and sing songs together and make up lyrics and, you know, move together in space, try different things with our bodies and our minds that, you know, end up in the final work in different ways. I would say another core value for us is collectivism. A lot of our work, you know, it kind of breaks that performer-spectator divide in a way that kind of builds a sense of community, I would say, especially through a lot of the ritual theater that ends up in our work, the masquerade that ends up in our work, and the fact that we do focus on kind of underrepresented stories or maybe excavating stories that you know, people don't know about. One of our other shows that we did that's not part of the trilogy that Gabe mentioned was a show called Time of Change, which we co-directed with Malesio Estrella and Joe Good of Joe Good Performance Group. And it was a massive, like, three different shows happening simultaneously in the streets of the Hate. And our section of the show talked about how the Hate was a Black neighborhood before the hippies came, and that the hippie movement, the counterculture movement, kind of had a gentrifying effect on the majority Black neighborhood that the Hate was. It was kind of almost considered a subdivision or a section of the Fillmore, in a way, like bled into the Fillmore. And our whole work was about that. We made a very intentional choice to cast Black Bay Area residents or and Bay Area collaborators in film and things like that that we use in the piece. And we made a concerted effort to interview, I think, oh my gosh, like 15 people, 20 people who are all, maybe it was a little less, but a lot of people who are all Black elders, residents, icons who have lived in the Bay for a long time or who are from the Bay. Some of those folks were like Amara Tabor Smith, Danny Glover, Randy Jordan, who is our good friend Molly's partner, who lived in San Francisco since the first Pride Parade and was involved in that.
The late Blackberry,
thank you, who was in Marlon Riggs' Tongues Untied. So yeah, we had a really heavy hitter cast of people who we wanted their voices to be the core and the sound score of our piece. And that was a very specific concerted effort to use the living archives of their stories to kind of share this story that I personally never knew and that I don't think a lot of people knew about the Hate. So yeah, collectivism, archives, community making, immersion. I think we really shine when we do most of our work, and we really shine in the spaces where we're able to do site-specific work. That's been a lot of what we do. And that's, I think, some of our most exciting pieces, like in the streets of the Hate, on the rooftop of a bar for Campo Santo, when we did that feast performance, this feast duet right after the quarantine lockdown ended. Grace Cathedral, which was literally inside a church. What else? Even our work about celebrity was kind of in a theater, and that was also outside on the UC Santa Cruz campus during their Afrofuturism festival. So I would also say, in addition to that immersion, that multimedia aspect that Gabe mentioned, like site-specific work, non-traditional venues, is a really big part of what we do.
The work that you all engage in, like most Black artists and artists of color, right? I've been talking a lot about, like, we're either acting our trauma, writing our trauma, directing our trauma, dancing our trauma, or watching our trauma. There's a healing in that, and because it's our stories, our way. But that doesn't necessarily mean that igniting the memories, whether they're current memories or they're generational memories, doesn't have impact. I'm wondering about the healing aspects of y'all's work. Gabe, you can start.
Yeah, you start, Gabe. I was about to say, you should go first.
Okay, the healing aspects of our work. It's a huge thing. I love the way you just described it. Like, there's sort of all these different ways of attending to trauma. And I also think that in some ways, you know, there's like a cautious optimism that I definitely think is implicit in how Chibwezi and I think about entering the archive. There's a cautious sort of like meticulous way of also finding the light instead of the lost histories, for example, of the Hate Ashbury or of these church spaces. If you saw Mouthful, you know, I think people saw that show and did cry, but also they were moved to tears because also it felt like a place that was finally safe. And so I think there's something about not just experiencing our histories through a lens of trauma, but there's other slippage perhaps of things coming up from the past, things that aren't quite gone, have never quite left, that I think are relevant to how I think the two of us connect over making work. I think the archive is, as like I said before, a living archive, exists in our bodies, exists in our ancestors, in our testimonies of folks who so are with us. I think there's been so much grief, and even our collective of folks that we've talked to, like losing Blackberry, for example, somebody who was becoming a really close elder of mine before they passed. But just the way that the art space is the only place to sort of to maintain a dialogue sometimes with folks that you can't talk to in real time, real space, which I find to be the medicine. So, I mean, in some ways, the healing comes from the ways that we can bend. I mean, we are time-based artists, so we are able to really reach back in time and excavate and scrape up things that maybe were left in the cast iron pot, right? And then use that for the next meal. I think it's a big part of it. But yeah, that's what I would say for now.
Yeah. I also, just since we're talking about people who've passed, I also want to name, it just feels important to say, Monica Hastings Smith was also a really big part of the first version of Mouthful that we made, who is a really incredible pillar of the Bay Area music scene and art scene, who, yeah, was a big part of some of our major sonic work that we made in that show. And it's also Gabe's cousin, we found out in the course of that show, which is really beautiful. But yeah, just I love what Gabe said. I think that a lot of that answers it really well.
This week's Resistance in Residence artists are the dynamic duo that make up Oyster Knife, a post-disciplinary performance company. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.